Morning, everybody. My name is Chris Dugan, and I am an alcoholic.
Last Friday night, July 21st of 1988.
I get to be part of a home group, which means I'm not homeless in AA, and which is a great thing. And additionally, I have a sponsor who probably most importantly knows he's my sponsor. And the coolest part is I'm very privileged that people in Alcoholics Anonymous, men in Alcoholics Anonymous, that call me their sponsor. I love being sober. I really loved your talk, Ebony. I relate so much to a lot of what you were talking about. And you know, our big book kind of goes into the idea and how it works. We've heard it every time, you know, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. And we know the three pertinent ideas, one of them everybody loves to chant to, but all three are pretty much important. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. And, you know, that last one, I think we chant that just because that's got, you know, a lot of hope that's embedded in it. And, you know, I should say right off the bat, like, it's my experience that the longer I'm sober, the better my childhood becomes. You know what I mean? Because, like, early on, it's a really comfortable thing to say, I'm an alcoholic, which means, like, I, you know, follow this pattern of my people. And, like, you know, my family is, you know, the background is, like, Atlantic City, like, pre-casinos, Boardwalk Empire, like Brigantine. Like, I grew up in all these, like, you know, sort of the family history of like the importance of our family. But the thing is, like, men typically don't live past like 48. You know what I mean? Like, they're usually dead pretty early on. And so and my case was no different. But, you know, the idea that I'm an alcoholic means I'm sort of subjected to this, like, this thing. And it's, I've got to fight this thing. And then, you know, you really can't have a hero without a villain. So, like, I'm like a flypaper to trauma and, like, collect all this injustice because I'm an alcoholic. And quite honestly, like, that was my MO from the very beginning. And just to kind of give you an idea of what, you know, I was, I kind of came here with is, you know, just like a little spot image is, I remember I had just like gotten a driver's license and was driving my little red pickup truck to go pick up my sponsor. And now in that pickup truck in the back, you kind of got to be ready for just about anything. Like, you know what I mean? Like, just like a prepper in my own mind of like, just in case. And so in there's like a loaded 12 gauge shotgun, some knives, cause you never know, this billy club that my grandfather had made. And like, I have all these things, right? And sort of, I'm kind of driving, which it's funny because like, I remember now, like I remember getting pulled over a lot and they never searched my car. I just thought, and like in DC, like I got sober in Arlington. Anyway, this particular one day I go to my sponsor's house in this pickup truck and my sponsor's working with this new guy. And he's like, hey, listen, we'll meet you at the meeting. I was like, all right. So I'm driving to the meeting. And so by now we have this routine of like going to like a couple of meetings a day. Like if you were brought here with somebody that it just seems ridiculous that you have to kind of sit through like three speakers, totally get it. Like I was like in that place where we just go from meeting to meeting. And this was the second meeting on the Sunday. And so I'm driving to the meeting and I notice it was going from my sponsor lived in McLean, Virginia, and we were driving to Arlington for a meeting. And I'm like kind of taking the back roads. And I notice on the side of this road, there's a bunch of people like standing around and like these kids and a couple of adults. And in the street is this this squirrel that had just recently gotten hit by a car. And like everybody's like, oh, that's terrible. Nobody's really sure what to do. And like, and I'm like, you know. I kind of pull over and talk to the guy that's like looking at this thing. He's like, it really needs to be put out of its misery. We need to call somebody, but it's clearly suffering. And I'm like, you know what? Don't worry about it. I got this. So I pull my car over and Out of the back, you know, I go through like, no, not the knife. Okay, here's the billy club. And the guy's like, thank you so much for doing this. He's explaining like the circle of life to his children. You know, they go around. I walk around the corner. And just right as soon as I take the first strike and bam, get it all over and done with, my sponsor pulls up with this newcomer and he looks at me and he's like, Dugan? I was like, it needed to die. He sees these people watching me and he's like, just get to the meeting, and drives off and you go to the meeting. Now, you know, here we are like 37 or whatever years later, and I'm a little bit stressing because I know Billy loves and his wife and like really loves this group. And there's so many wonderful home group members, and I'm getting these texts and it's like, you know, I told my wife we want to leave at 7 o'clock and I'm a little neurotic and it's 6:45. I'm like, we got to go. And she's like, honey, we're just going to get to the meeting. Kind of the same thing. Full circle. Now my wife is saying the same stuff my sponsor's saying. And sometimes it's just about just getting to the meeting. But our experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, tells us that, you know, our personal adventures before and after. There's another part in the 12 and 12. It's the last paragraph. My sponsor, my late sponsor, Johnny, kind of pointed this out to me after I'd been here a little while. Because honestly, I was like, a lot of times I would hear talks and I would be sure people were talking about the black part. But I'm hearing a lot of white part of the big book. And in other words, like it would seem like I would hear these creative talks about the stuff that are very basic ideas. And I'm like, what am I missing? So I really got into the academics. Like I thought if I could study and know the big book, like my life would get better. And it would seem like I would listen to these talks that would sound like a TED talk, right? And I just want you to know right now, I tend to gravitate in that direction. And if you hear any of that coming from me, what you're really hearing is my ego. There's nothing creative. There's nothing complicated about the solution we have. The path we have is just ridiculously simple, stemming from just a very simple surrender. And quite honestly, like, you know, the academics and a lot of the, you know, a lot of the intensity that we put on ourselves to really like try to figure out what's in the psyche of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and like, you know, getting into Roland Hazard, some of us branch off into Carl Jung and like getting into all this stuff, quite honestly, should bring us back to the same place, which is just simply surrender. And it's my experience that, you know, through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, in a fully surrendered state, the 12 steps are automatic. In other words, when I rid myself of self, I'm automatically filled up with some kind of higher power. And so navigating that stuff. So I just want to say that right off the bat. And most talks begin with the idea, like I knew I was different than everybody else. But it won't take me long to actually really convince you, that really I kind of was different. I felt different. I looked different. I experienced difference. And when you live in a state of feeling different than everybody else, it's very hard to understand how not to live life on the basis that I am the scene, not a part of the scenery. Because when you're in a constant struggle and a constant fight and, you know, looking for your place, everywhere I go, it's almost like I'm my own personal action adventure movie. And quite honestly, from the time that I can earliest remember when I discovered, I like how Bill Wilson uses that word, there I discovered drinking, like as if it's like, you know, he's been sailing and like, you know, fighting scurvy and finally there's like land, like it's this discovery. Like that was my experience with discovering alcohol, except my experience was there I was. I was just starting the sixth grade. Now, by then, I had been people well-meaning. I'd gone through all this testing and this idea of being learning disabled was brand new. Now, my mom was an educator. I have huge respect for educators. Actually, my wife is also an educator. And like there's a lot of noise around education, and there's like signal. And the stuff teachers have to put up with. Well, my mom was very much the same. She had this experience where she had worked in this place called Devereux up in Pennsylvania, which was for special people, special kids. And it was filled with a school of a conversation that I was very familiar with. And here's the conversation that I was given early on to say, your case is different. Christopher, your ability's here and your potential's there. We need to figure out how to close that gap, right? The ability potential conversation, right? And then they'll tell you like how to fill that up. And I kind of attempted to do that, and it really just kind of stressed me out as a little guy. In fact, like some people think like, forceful structure really does that, and like, just, pay attention and like controlling. But I'm like, my brain's going a million miles an hour, and I just got all this stuff. Also, I was born without enamel on my teeth. So I had these yellow teeth. And when you have yellow teeth and you're a kid, like kids are cruel and like, how come you don't brush your teeth, right? And so eventually I was just like, you know what? There's no point. And so, but I had a dentist who like had a little bit of a soft spot and kind of, was lived up the street, and he was my dentist, and he's like experimenting with these various paints, which I think were like probably somewhat radioactive because he's painting this stuff and it kind of looked like white out and other stuff. So I've got this stuff on my teeth and like in constant pain, and and this is going to stress me out. So then enter in like right about that time, my sister had this thing with like PCP and vodka. When she was like on her PCP phase, she's completely psychotic. And when she was like on her vodka phase, she was just actually pretty cool, but like it just turned into a thing. So she winds up in rehab. Turns out like my dad disappears on a business trip. Turns out he goes into the psych ward right about this time. My mom goes from reading like Charlotte's Web to me and like reading these books because she thinks like exposing me to that's really going to help me, and actually it did. But then we went to like reading like she's bringing home like Al-Anon family group books and like Under the Influence, and like I'm learning about the disease of alcoholism. Meanwhile, I'm a really stressed out little guy with yellow teeth. Can't get my homework done because I'm in the special class and I can't get a sticker. And my first resentment's popping up because I've got that teacher and they're giving me this ability potential conversation. And it's, and then they're giving me this stuff to like calm my nerves and my stomach because I've got acid reflux from all the stress, which by the way, was giving me hemorrhoids. So there I am. I'm 6 grand. I got yellow teeth. I'm sitting on an inflatable donut. I've got under the influence going at home. My sister's going psychotic. My dad's winding up in West Virginia because he can't stay sober. And what is it that I need to do to match that or kind of close that gap between ability potential? That's the discovery. Sixth grade, that's my discovery of alcohol. Quite honestly, thank God it worked. I mean, honestly, thank God it worked. Because I honestly don't know if I could have made it through my first resentment. I won't say her name. I used to say her name. My sixth grade teacher, who never did actually give me a sticker. It's funny, now my kids, like on my birthday, they'll like give me these stickers, like, see, Dad, you got a sticker. But that's when I discovered alcohol. Tanqueray is what I found. And then I found whatever else was in the other kids' neighborhoods. I got really close with the friends whose parents kept wine in boxes. But the effect produced by alcohol, and Ebony talked a lot about it, it's essentially what I was looking for. And quite honestly, like if you don't relate to the whole like yellow teeth, hemorrhoids thing, I mean, quite honestly, it's just a dramatic way of saying it became very clear as to the effect produced by alcohol. Now that effect comes in the form of a solution. And what is it? What am I really solving for? Right? And that's where that part in the big book kind of is, or actually it's in the big book in the doctor's opinion. Like this is all kind of hidden stuff, but I just couldn't hear. I thought what made an alcoholic is the way they drank. And quite honestly, the way an alcoholic drinks, as far as I was concerned, a lot of the people that I ran with kind of drank the way I drank. But what they didn't experience was that sense of restlessness, irritability, and discontent when they didn't drink. Another thing that I related to early on, and most people, a lot of alcoholics don't necessarily have, this doesn't make me an alcoholic, but Dr. Bob mentions this one interesting tidbit in there, is that he really never suffered terrible hangovers. And I have that experience too, where I would start drinking and it became a creative mix of whatever, oftentimes in coffee cans, random mixed stuff, because it's just weird to see an 11-year-old, like, you know, kicking back and chugging a fifth. So, like, I needed the effect more than anything. And it just so happened, like, I was it. That's how I drank. But, you know, when it talks about in the big book, essentially, is under the lash of alcohol, we are, or in the 12 and 12, the last paragraph, under the lash of alcohol, we are driven to AA. And there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. It's then and only then that we become as open-minded to conviction and willing to listen as the dying can be. We stand ready to do anything which will lift the merciless obsession from us. The reason why I have that memorized is because it's so impactful, and not because I just want to sound good from the podium, but quite honestly, the part that I missed is also that part that's in the big book about how it works. It's, you know, our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. Before and after what? You know, what am I discovering in Alcoholics Anonymous? And so, you know, my early experience, the way I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and when you're in the sixth grade and you drink like that and you kind of, you know, build trying to solve for that restlessness, that irritability, and that discontent, it kind of stands out against the other, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 year olds. It kind of stands out. That's how you wind up in rehab, by the way. That's just a direct beeline, and lots of concerned people. But what would happen is, you know, the book talks about the phenomenon of craving. What I saw it as is I had a very high tolerance, and, you know, the idea of controlling and enjoying my drinking. That's an important idea, is because I would kind of get lost in that, you know, the idea of controlling and enjoying. And I used to listen to that as like separate things, because I could look at places where I could control it and I could look at places where I can enjoy it. But the truth for me is, when those two things were combined, it was an impossible, horrific cycle. It oftentimes required supplements, so to speak, to be able to control and enjoy my drink. But quite honestly, what I couldn't control is that once I started, it doesn't mean it always ended in disaster, but what I will tell you is, once I started drinking, I could not accurately predict how things were going to go. And so that's another way of thinking about unmanageability, is that once I start drinking, if I cannot reasonably say for sure how that drinking binge is going to go, there's probably a problem. But that's only part of the problem. There's another part of the problem, which is the next day when, or the next 2 days when I'm sure I'm not going to repeat what that just was. There's this, you know, what my friend Bob calls, you know, this invisible spring. Actually, it came from Clancy, but, you know, this invisible spring that's inside of me that just kind of tightens up. You know what I mean? It's that kid that's, you know, that sixth grade kid with the, you know, the hemorrhoids and the, you know, the restlessness, and you're just looking for that. And it is 100% my experience that my state of sobriety, when I try and do it myself, looks exactly like mental illness. New sobriety and untreated alcoholism, and I wouldn't even say new sobriety. I would say untreated alcoholism in the context of what we do in AA looks, for me, exactly like mental illness. Our book talks about restlessness, irritability, and discontent. We have new, you know, terms for that, and, you know, all kinds of interesting stuff about, you know, trauma and anxiety and depression. And quite honest, I struggled with all that stuff early on. It's not to say that those things don't exist, but what I'm telling you is, when I'm trying, you know, my discovery of after I come here, part of those personal adventures before and after, like the personal adventures before, thank goodness I got sober before social media. Because those personal, I mean, for you guys that have gotten sober in, like, you know, the TikTok and, you know, all the Instagram stuff and Facebook, like, That's awful. Like a snapshot of like all the stuff you probably shouldn't remember. It's like God's gift to the alcoholic of blackouts, right? But there it is. And black. Well, so I got sober before. Those are the personal, like those personal adventures I understood. What became a little bit more difficult to understand is the personal adventures that I experienced once I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would hear things like, don't drink no matter what. Don't drink no matter what. And I was like, that's a really good idea. And like, and it's like, why come to AA? Just don't drink no matter what. That's all we got to do is don't drink no matter, which is actually true, right? In order to get here. But there's something that occurs that when I'm not drinking and I don't have a solution, I just get a little bit haywire. You know, there's something inside that like, no matter how good of an idea I have about like self-help, or I'm going to eat right and I'm going to work out and I'm going to, you know, do all this stuff and, you know, kind of will myself into living right so that I can, you know, kind of feed that false idea that normal is a cure to alcoholism, that if I look normal, that I will be cured of alcoholism, which is honestly just a fool's errand. Because we have this thing, and the book calls it, the book uses the word delusion, right? In rehab, they just said denial, right? Denial is kind of, and all denial is really just a lie. That's what denial is, as I've been taught. Like, I'm just lying. But the delusion is, I have no idea what the truth is. And I do the best I can with what I have. And so living my life on the basis of normal is a cure, you know, early in sobriety just kind of ran me down that path, and I would end up in these blockades. That's where sponsorship really comes in handy. But in July 21st of 1988, my mom dropped me off at Arlington Hospital and said, don't come home. Which, and I knew she loved me. She spent a lot of time. So I knew it wasn't something that she really wanted to do. I had been living summers over here in Boise, Virginia, at this place called in Orkney Springs. And I was a camp lifeguard, and I found out very quickly, and I was going to like try and stay sober and like get into this place. It's a beautiful place, actually, a place called Shrine Mont. And I was like going to kind of get my stuff together and sort of live the ideal life. And within like 2 weeks of being there, I'm like, you know, dissecting Pink Floyd and like just losing my mind, not drinking. And then I found out very quickly, yeah, Final Cut was brutal. And I found out very quickly, like the dishwashers were having a good time. So I got in with the dishwashers, lived with the dishwashers, and it was kind of off to the races, driving up to Harrisonburg, loading up, coming home, getting drunk, and they would barely be able to make it to the, you know, the morning breakfast, and I'm ready to go to work. And I got to drink exactly the way I wanted. And after a few summers of doing that, and then, you know, wintertime trying to get my stuff together and, you know, battling all kinds of stuff, my parents like were kind of worried about me during the year. They wanted me to be more like my brother, so they decided to buy me a shotgun. That, by the way, that's the same shotgun that was in the back of that pickup truck. Bad idea if you're a parent and like one, you know, want to make your kid normal. Buying them firearms is probably not the best, but I understood why they did it. But they wanted me to like go hunting with my brother, and like I just felt sorry for the deer and probably spent more time pointing that shotgun at myself than anything else. But they worried about me, and like I would battle this stuff, and so I would have to drink. And so that is how I wound up in rehab in Arlington Hospital. She dropped me off because she didn't know what to do with me. Said, don't come home. And my real discovery of Alcoholics Anonymous was not unlike drinking. It was a discovery. And I didn't realize it at the time. But I remember one of those first meetings. It was a meeting, I remember it like it was yesterday, this meeting called Westover in Falls Church, Virginia. It's still there. In fact, I've run across some of the old timers, which is why I mentioned it. One of the old timers actually in this home group. But I remember this discovery. I remember feeling that awkwardness of early sobriety, where I put the plug in the jug and I'm listening to people saying how they stop drinking and their life gets so much better. And that's, I want to subscribe to that, but quite honestly, like there's something else going on. Like maybe I have these problems other than alcohol, and there I am. And like my my palms are sweaty, and that little detox thing that we go through that doesn't feel like it's detox. And I'm in this room, and I get sober in the summertime, and all of a sudden I'm like scared about all kinds of weird stuff. I mean, I just get paranoid about the weirdest stuff. 80s was a big AIDS thing. Like people were really concerned about AIDS, and I'm in these, in these meetings in DC and in, my home group actually at that point was like in DuPont Circle, and like, I'm just kind of freaked out. And so, but here's my discovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these were meeting makers, by the way. And this home group and you guys that host this and put this on, these are meeting makers. They say meeting makers make it. And I want to make a clarification because I badmouthed that for years because I watched a lot of people make a lot of meetings and get drunk until I found out where that really comes from. That term does not come from people who attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It comes from Bill Wilson recognizing in a article that he had written that there's a strong correlation to the people that make the meeting happen making it in sobriety. And so the idea that, and so this is a home group filled with meeting makers, not just sitting in meetings, but making the meeting happen, putting together the service work. Well, this guy happened to be a meeting maker and he was there early and I was there and I'm just sitting at the table and I'm, rubbing my palms across the top of my jeans and like just feeling restless. And like, I'm dropped off at Arlington with no real resources. Like, I'd gotten fired from that job or basically asked to leave Shrinemont, which at that place you had to do a lot to irritate, the family that ran it. And I found that button to push and pushed it. And so I don't have a lot of money. And I'd been smoking at that time and everybody kind of smoked back in the 80s, especially in the meetings. And this guy, I remember, he opened up a pack of cigarettes and put a Zippo on the table, slid it over, and he said, "Chris, it's good to see you. You remembered my name because he'd seen me in a meeting where I was, saying I was in my first 30 days. He said, "Chris, it's good to see you. Welcome. Help yourself." And he put the cigarettes and the Zippo on the table. And honestly, that was a discovery. Because what I recognized in him is what he recognized in me. You see, it takes one to know one. There's this phrase we have in AA, if you spot it, you got it. We hear that. Oftentimes, that's usually what the sponsor says to a sponsee when they're like angry at all the people that are messing up, right? If you spot it, you got it. Which is in my case, always true. But there's another part of that too. If you spot it, you got it works on everything that you see in people that you absolutely admire and truly love. Suffering is one of those things, right? We cannot, when we've suffered, it's very easy for us, as long as I'm not caught up in my own stuff, to be able to identify other suffering. He recognized that in me. He knew exactly what to say. And the gift that he delivered, very much like I'd always hoped for coming out of alcohol, was to find that, that state of comfort. He was able to deliver that. And I didn't know it at the time, but kind of he gave me a sense of relevance, which I'd been searching for. He allowed me to find a place where I belonged. He used my name. And he gave me at least somewhat of a purpose of being there, a reason. And I felt loved. Those are the three things he gave me. And I needed to feel relevant. I needed to feel like I had a place where I belonged, and I needed to experience some kind of love, right? That word care in the third step. That later came in really useful as I went through the steps and truth without love is cruel, is what my sponsor said to me. And that's the whole thing in this journey through the 12 steps is that, my fourth step ultimately became, it's a listing of liabilities, but not in the lens of I'm going to make a list of why I suck or why I'm terrible, right? It's not a list of why I'm terrible. What it becomes a list of is an opportunity on how I can be comfortable. It's actually a list. The inventory is a listing of opportunities when that word care is used in the third step. Well, he delivered all three of those things for me so that at least I felt comfortable in the meeting. And I found a place in Alcoholics Anonymous, very sick. He was a meeting maker. He was able to spot it, get out of his own stuff, recognize my suffering, and allowed me to be there. See, this didn't make sense until I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit. I was, you know, raised initially in Alcoholics Anonymous on fairly loose sponsorship, just get in the car, like just get to the meeting, Dugan, like that sponsor. He wound up kind of having a difficult time, got into a relationship, and then kind of moved away. Luckily, he had a sponsor, very hardline sponsor, that guy was. And, you know, it was more like not just taking you through the steps, it was literally taking you through the steps. Like we were bringing in speakers from out of town. We kind of turned into this hardened shell of a home group where it started out where a ton of us got sober in the 80s. And as we got sober in the, like everybody was just kind of, you know, Nancy Reagan's like, you know, kind of the first lady at the time, for those of you too old to remember, like just say no and like straight incorporated, go here and like, you know, and like, you know, just say no. And like, they're just throwing everybody into rehab. Well, I was kind of in that batch. And then you get all these groups of alcoholics and like, you have to go to these meetings. And don't you remember this? Like there were a ton of us that just got sober in the Northern Virginia area all at once. And when you get a large group of alcoholics together with no steps and no traditions, no real solution, that's not called a group. That's called a gang. And we were a gang that just kind of like hung around meetings, feeling entitled. Meeting makers make it. And we'd come in and sit in the meeting and talk about, you know, those, you know, making fun of the big book thumpers and making fun of all that. And there's a wonderful sort of idea in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I learned at that point. And that is Alcoholics Anonymous itself is a self-cleaning oven. Every once in a while, and it just, you know, depends on when, even in my own personal life, the heat kind of gets turned up. And then you find out what has structure and what's just like loose and crusty, and the loose and crusty stuff burns off. And I hung out with a lot of loose and crusties. Like, this is where grace kind of is. Like, you know, you see these hands and this influence, and like, whether or not you believe in a higher power, there is one truth for every single alcoholic. If you identify, and I identified, and this was pointed out to me, like in the doctor's opinion, it describes alcoholism. What most people miss is kind of that last sentence, which is the most important. And as we go, and it's in the preface, it's before chapter one, because he's a non-alcoholic, but he like knows what he's talking about relative to alcoholics and has enough humility to say both what he knows and doesn't know about alcoholism and recognizes the importance of it takes one to know one, right? So that's our Dr. Silkworth. But the last sentence on there is, although he may have come to scoff, he may remain to pray. Now, that's an interesting statement from a medical doctor. I don't know how many of you have ever been in a consulting scenario, at least a clinical consulting scenario where you're meeting with your doctor and your doctor asks you if you pray. If that's ever the case, you're not in a good meeting. This is not good news. Whatever the doctor's about to say after that, it is bad news. Horrific. Do you pray? What do you mean, do I pray? And that's essentially where the doctor leaves us to start the big book. And so if you're one of those that relates in and that actually identifies with the nature of alcoholism, there's an embedded promise in that. And it's repeated later on in We Agnostics, you know, to live on the basis of a spiritual program or live an alcoholic life are not easy alternatives to face. Now, if you, you know, I'm sure many of you know non-alcoholics. And if you say, would you rather live on a spiritual basis or live in the destruction of alcoholism? Like, can you make a good choice between which one you'd like? Like, it's pretty obvious to them. But to us, that's not obvious. It's not obvious because I'm right, whatever that is. I've got alcoholism. I'm a victim. I've got, come from this family. I've got this trauma, like all these flypaper. And essentially my early sobriety was characterized by coming to terms with this idea. And here's the fundamental truth of my experience. A higher power always shows up for alcoholics, always. If I identify to the doctor's opinion, a higher power will always show up in one form or other. It might not be a higher power I like, but it's certainly going to be a power greater than myself. Because if I've admitted powerlessness and unmanageability relative to living my own life sober or drunk, a higher power always shows up. Now it's just a matter of my willingness and openness to recognize where that higher power lives. When I'm desperate, it's actually not difficult. That's why they call it the gift of desperation. Because, I mean, I was dying to meet this guy. I remember it like it was yesterday. The reason why that discovery in that guy in that early meeting that gave me relevance, that gave me a sense of, belonging, and that allowed me to like have this vision that I was loved, he was able to deliver that to me very simply because I was desperate. And so, in those first few years, I wouldn't say that there was any coordinated or organized way of going through the steps, but the steps do show up in one form or other. They either happen to me or through me. And so it was just a matter of willingness. And this is where sponsorship really comes in handy, really comes in handy. And, my experience with sponsorship early on was I needed fellowship. I needed that sense of connection. I was that kid that just felt like a rubber ball. And if I could at least get inside the pack, that's the one thing I knew. If I hung out inside the pack and kind of ran, that I was less likely going to get picked off, because I just constantly felt like there was this threat. I didn't know what it was. I mean, I'll just give an example. And this is not everybody's experience, but I got tested for AIDS like 45 times. Not kidding. I don't know where that came from. I didn't live a lifestyle that was even exciting enough to be an expo, but I just suddenly like, I just picked the most horrific thing and I just obsessed of like just worrying about dying. And I'm sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous early on, and I'm watching people like eat their fingers and like pick cuticles and make themselves, we do weird stuff when we're like trying to pay attention. And I'm like, I'm just seeing all this stuff and it's just freaking me out. And I'm just worried about this. Now, what does this have to do with not drinking? As far as I was concerned, nothing. This is just the crazy, like, rubber ball. That's the familiar thing in my mind that I used to drink over. And I'd explain to people, I'm really worried about this. And they'd kind of laugh, and like the people at the AIDS hotline, like knew my name. Like I could tell you the different Planned Parenthoods that like would do the test, and I couldn't find one that would do the Western blot test, just the PCR test, which is not, it's got a much longer antigen stage. And like I'm really like this guy, right? If that means nothing to you, like, well done. Like, but like, I'm just kind of like, what does this have to do with not drinking? And it's that restlessness. It's that irritability. What it is it's a higher power trying to show up in my life. Because I needed to rediscover and rediscover and rediscover what that gentleman had given me to find my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what a sponsor was essentially, he met me where I was. Just get to the meeting, dude. You know what I mean? And that's what early sobriety was. And so it wasn't necessarily a sequential time, but I wasn't ready to hear it. And there came a time in my sobriety where I was ready to hear it, because quite honestly, I was going to be that flaky part of the oven that burns off when the heat gets turned up. And the heat in this case was my head, and it was my heart, and it was me looking for something. I'd always been a kind of seeker. And so that's when I started going through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when I discovered the fatal nature of my situation. It wasn't right away. Quite honestly, Alcoholics Anonymous looked exactly like any of the other consequences I ever faced. And I treated it accordingly. It was just something that needed to be done so that I could get on to the next thing. And I'm just going to wait for whatever that next thing is. And I treated AA very much like that. In fact, the people I ran with treated AA like that. And there was nobody really that we could hear that would tell us any different. And every once in a while, we'd hear speakers or we'd see people that, you know, we absolutely identified with, but where they are and where they said they were two totally different things. They could identify our suffering, but I couldn't really identify their recovery. And so until it came to the time where I had to start taking action that I didn't firmly believe would solve my problem, but I had enough faith that they knew my suffering and they were someplace else that I wasn't. That was the open window. And it wasn't until I'd been around AA for quite some time. That's when I discovered the fatal nature of my situation because, you know, sadly enough, a lot of those people that I'd gotten sober with started dying off. And it was like, you know, and it would be a friendly conversation of like, hey man, if I started drinking, would you still hang out with me? Like, and I loyalty is a thing, right? Absolutely. Yes. You know, I'm not going anywhere, you know, unconditional love and, you know, new playground, new play friends. Like, you know, I would talk about these old ideas that I would have and how I was, but the fact was, is I never really changed the spiritual toolkit, so to speak. So I would talk about old ideas as if they were something I didn't do anymore. But the fact is, I'm still full of resentment. I'm still full of fear. I've got tracks up my arm, not from doing anything fun, but from getting blood taken for AIDS tests. Like, I've got, you know, weapons in the back of my car, like trash in my vehicle is almost like ammunition on some days. And I'd go into the meeting and share. And by now, I learned this vocabulary of like, you know, a spiritual reprieve conditioned upon the man, you know, and I'm like talking this beautiful stuff and I'm freaking out and I'm running my life directly into a wall. And that's when I discovered the biggest fool's errand of Alcoholics Anonymous for this alcoholic is trying to make normal look like a cure to alcoholism. That if I look normal, that I could be normal. And in a delusional mind and in an unchanged situation, and that's the one that I saw everybody, because quite honestly, it's interesting. I discovered this line in the book. It kind of highlights exactly there. It's in We Agnostics. And my sponsor said it, and then I went back and read it as I think, Eric, we were going through the book when I discovered this. But what it talks about is this idea that deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Although it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, in some form or other, it is there. And so I called up my sponsor. I'm like, hey, Johnny, question. It says that I've got God inside of me. And if I'm fundamentally egotistical and I'm constantly broken and if I'm an alcoholic, how is that possible? Right? And he's like, well, son, he said, that's why when we say the prayer, it's our Father, not my Father. But I'm just one of God's kids. And he reminded me of something that a man who raised him in Alcoholics Anonymous had said, which really helped me at the time. It said, what he said was, is that what I was looking for was what I was looking with. Sponsors can be kind of Yoda-y sometimes. You will be. You know what I mean? And like, but this was one of those times where he really, you know, it was much too simple. That, you know, that fundamental idea that lived within me is essentially that the higher power I'm looking for lives within inside me. There's like this ideal person that I was born as. And that the idea of these obscurations, now that word meant something to me too that I'll share with you. So, you know, actually, and what it says is actually we're fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. And the idea of an obscuration is significant to me because I had this secret. I couldn't really read. I was in that class. I was going to quit school. Long story short, this guy Sandy and this guy Hal kind of took pity on me. It turned out I really loved flying. And, you know, they urged me. They're like, you know, you could go fly airplanes. And I went to the recruiter and they're like, not on your life, dude. So I went to the local airport out of Manassas. Back then it was called Whiskey 10 of all things, and slapped my money on the table. And they're like, you know, And I went flying, like first run. Like I went out there with like $35 at this place. And the next thing I know, I'm flying this little bug smasher that's like, you know, barely, you know, maybe, you know, 6 mil, like teeny, like steel between me and like 3,000 feet. And like, they're letting me fly. And like, I land and like, I was hooked, right? And so I got into the flying thing, and it was kind of a secret because I kind of felt dumb because I barely graduated high school. I could barely read. And like, you know, you just don't see that, you know, type of person like in professional aviation. I'm like, well, I just kind of kept it a secret, right? And my sponsors urging me to go this stuff. Anyway, I go through all that stuff and I get through my private instrument commercial. Wonderful story, interesting. But the point of the story is, as an instrument pilot, it became time to become get an instrument license, right? And so as a private pilot, you use like, you know, the horizon, like the sun's there, you know, airplane flies good in the air, not good through granite, right? Cumulogranite versus cumulonimbus, you know. So like, stay away from like that obvious stuff. But then as you get your instrument license, you have to deal with what are called obstructions or obscurations. And obscurations, the airplane flies just fine, but you have to rely on different instrumentation. But the aerodynamics of the airplane are as perfect in, you know, clear and azalean skies as they are. You just have to learn how to use different instruments and different sensors on the airplane. And so obscuration in a weather forecast just talks about the things. Kids are amazed. Like, I'm a professional pilot today. Like, kids come up to the front and they're amazed because it'll be like raining. And I'm like, check this out. In like 10 minutes, it's going to be a beautiful day. We're going to climb right through it. And the sun is always shining. And it just blows their mind because they can't imagine anything else other than the rain we're experiencing. I am that kid every time. I still, to this day, like, we'll be flying an instrument approach. I can't believe this works. Like, it just kind of blows my mind. Like, every time, like, it really does work. You know what I mean? Flying a, you know, a Cat 3 ILS or whatever. But so these obscurations. And so the navigation, you know, sort of metaphor works perfectly for Alcoholics Anonymous, because what are the obscurations? Calamity, pomp, and worship of other things. And those are the things we navigate through in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, learning at tools like surrender. That calamity is just the stuff I get into, the, you know, the fight that I have or the desires and the things that are way of my desires. Pomp is just anything that I put in between me and you. As Chuck C said, you know, the ego is just anything I use to separate. Could be, you know, I'm better than, but more frequently for people like me, it's the same ego that says that I'm worse than, that I'm that I don't deserve, that I'm an imposter. And then the worship of other things is the false idea that if I get something material, that I will feel something spiritual. That material can fix the spiritual, right? And so what steps and what really all the steps after really step one reference is, how do I surrender those obscurations? How do I let them go? And it's no more difficult than that. My journey in Alcoholics Anonymous has been one of just amazing highs, and more importantly, and what's significant, is amazing lows. You know, I talked about sponsorship early on and the need to get connected to a home group, because I did need to learn to connect with people and like co-function and learn, you know, have an open mind and like have that fellowship. I needed a sense of belonging and a sense of society. And quite honestly, that's what I thought sponsorship was, is I'm accountable. My sponsor tells me what to do and I do it, which is very clean, which is actually awesome. Except my sponsor was a complete disaster in his own personal relationships, divorced like 3 and 4 times, like just, but he was always there to help alcoholics. And so the point is like that sponsor that I kind of had been accountable to, I actually got a resentful at. I got really resentful at periodically, because I would feel a certain way, I'm following direction, and I would feel like it's their fault, which is kind of how I treated alcoholism. Honestly, you know, I showed up late to work. Oh, it's my alcoholism. You know, I, you know, freaked out in traffic. It's my alcoholism. No, it's not. It's because I'm a jerk and self-centered. You know, even in that second point that we read, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, that God couldn't, what if he were sought? And so I learned very quickly that no human power can relieve my alcoholism, that essentially he provided me a conduit, and that sponsorship very simply is an AA hack in modern language. It's essentially looking at a system that works, tapping into it, not trying to reinvent the wheel, but finding the tracks that have already been laid and the path that's already been laid, and just getting in line. That's really what sponsorship started out to be, is just following their experience. And then it's turned into a more beautiful thing, which is unfettered access into both what works and what doesn't. The second part's probably more important than the first part, because the first part I'm attracted to. The second part, in being able to identify what doesn't work. And that means my sponsor has permission to identify those things through his experience to where I'm falling short. And I have a sponsor who's very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And so that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, that see that God couldn't, would if he were sought. And essentially the idea of God is no longer this idea of something that I'm looking for outside of myself. Is, yeah, I've learned to take responsibility. My life is my fault, which is what my sponsor said early on. And my sobriety is my responsibility. But that responsibility extends to the fact that what am I doing today to be the meeting maker? That going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my experience, is just the price of admission to be able to stay sober. That's it. And so, you know, whatever that adventure looks like, that, you know, the right way or the wrong way, the price of admission is just simply getting sober is going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my experience. But more importantly, staying sober is taking other people through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people have had kind of take issue with that. And most of the time, the people would take the most issue with that are people that haven't been through all 12 steps. So I hear you. And I'm not saying you're drunk if you haven't gone through all 12. But what I am saying is the real joy and the beauty of the 12 steps did, for me, did not come through going through the 12 steps initially. It was, you know, I said truth without love is cruel, right? And I mean, the fourth step was just this listing of, you know, all my secrets and all the stuff that I felt made me lower than. And, you know, I could see like both. It's the weirdest thing having this list of like where I could feel arrogant and better than everybody else. And like one line later, I'm like the worst, don't deserve anything, should be shot and killed. And, you know, the Catholics are, you know, just all that stuff. No, I mean, I really, like I was looking for anything to be a victim. And so what the middle ground was finding that word care in that third step. And so finding that word care was just simply, I just had to change my attitude, my perspective. And my outsides didn't change early on either. I mean, I had to go, you know, went to end up going to, they changed a little bit. Early sobriety, I was like the first kid to start a AA meeting in Loudoun County Public Schools. I'd been kicked out of the one I was in the rest in and got sent out to Sterling, Virginia. And the agreement was, like, they heard I was in rehab and they had no idea what to do with me. And I'm like, well, I'm going to AA. They're like, well, we've got problems here. Would you start a meeting here and like take our pro? And I started like this AA meeting in the school, and I didn't have to go to any classes at all. Like, they graduated me. Yeah. By the way, you pay a price for that later. Yeah, my testing scores weren't really good to qualify at Northern Virginia Community College to get me. I had to start with some real remedial classes. But you know, kind of going through on that experience and kind of building on that experience of like, you know, finding opportunities for surrender. So for me, it started with a home group. It you know, continued in with sponsorship, going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, finding a solution, and then really just simply finding opportunities to be that meeting maker, getting into the it takes one to know one. Now I get excited when I see people, like many people in this group, very strongly, there are people that I admire. I don't look at it as what do they have that I don't. I look at it as, what exactly is blocking me from being that? Whatever that example is. If somebody's smiling and I'm not smiling that day, I don't think, I'm never going to smile again. It's more like, you know, how come I'm not lighter? What's got me, you know, what's got me? And that becomes just a functional, that's where the 10th step really comes in handy. I love what you said about, you know, on an ongoing basis, you know, step 11 begins with when we retire at night. Isn't that interesting? When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. There's a big assumption in that, by the way, using that word constructive when reviewing my day. The truth is like, I'm always going to review my day. Same thing. The next paragraph starts with on awakening. We think about the 24 hours ahead. Now, that is something that is going to happen to all of us, whether or not it's I'm exhausted, I want to just shut my brain off, today was crazy, tomorrow will be better. That's reviewing my day. Whether or not it's constructive, I don't know, but there's always this kind of review. And then on awakening, we think about the 24 hours ahead. The interesting thing is those two paragraphs are completely separate, but right next to each other. There's a big assumption between when we retire at night and on awakening. And that is a big thing that's really good for us alcoholics, which is a good night's sleep, right? And that's a big deal. Like being able to sleep well at night is one of the first dividends that I experienced. Like I kind of remember like back in the day, like I'd get home, I'd feel good in the meeting and I'd get home after the meeting and I would like, you know, like just do weird stuff. Like if you couldn't figure that out, like I'd like light this candle and like it had all kinds of weird stuff in it and like, you know, just get in my head and I, you know, sneak up on the roof and go smoke cigarettes and think about dying. And like, and then I'd like eventually just get exhausted and go to bed. And then I'd wake up with this hole in my gut. And you can't say this in AA meetings because I'm sober now and I put the plug in the jug and my life's so great. And, you know, I have this spiritual reprieve or. And so the reason why I say that is because if you're newly sober and you're here, and you're feeling a little tweaked and this seems like a consequence, I get it. I would just ask that you stay long enough until you actually see where the solution lives. This is not a consequence. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a consequence, despite what it looks like with court slips and, you know, and being, you know, sentenced to AA through your EAP or your, you know, grandmother making you promise you're going to go to AA. It seems like a consequence, but it really isn't. There's this thing that occurs and this transformation that occurs as a direct result of surrender. And sometimes it's letting go of the things, the very things that we think keep us alive. But sometimes those things are the very things we need to let go. And finding a sponsor and walking through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my experience, does become the easier, softer way. Remember what I said, when you're in a meeting and somebody sits down next to you and they kind of smell like booze, and they're not being too disruptive, they're ruining a perfectly good drunk by sitting in an AA meeting, and that's exactly where they should be. They're sitting in there, they're looking for those three things too. They just want to feel at least like they have a place, relevant, and they're just looking to be loved. Come do what we do. You know, and I add the caveat, as long as they're not being disruptive, because we've seen our share of that. Sometimes there's a little too drunk and they're not going to remember it anyway. So I've been on those 12-step calls where you have to like write your name, like, you want to get sober, you told me. When you wake up, we met. We're going to go to an AA meeting together. And I every once in a while, I've gotten those calls like, you know, hey, I know this is weird. Did we meet? Yes, yes, we met. You want to get sober and go to a meeting. Okay, good. I love being sober. I put Alcoholics Anonymous at the center of my life, and I've certainly not been disappointed, nor do I have any regrets since I've been here. I needed to hear that when I was new. This is not a consequence, it's a solution. I built a wonderful life and have had a wonderful life built for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought ever that I'd be able to form a partnership because as you can see, there's like, doesn't seem like there's a lot of space in this head for more than just me, right? But as I let a higher power in and rid myself of self and have tried to allow myself to automatically be filled with God with not a lot of struggle, I've been able to establish a relationship and was able to get married in Alcoholics Anonymous. We had an AA wedding. And I was, you know, and again, I was like, you know, our first night, I just get these little glimpses, right? Our first night when we're on our honeymoon, right after we were married, and like, I'm just kind of in my head because all I really had to do was like plan the honeymoon. And we're down there in St. John. We went to the, and like, we you know set up our place and we went and went to an AA meeting the first night of our honeymoon. And sitting in the meeting, and I'm so in my head because I thought I screwed it up because the AC wasn't working quite right, and I'm going to be a terrible husband, and you know, I mean, just self-centeredness was just, and like, you know, Joni slept great, but we get sitting in there in the meeting, and there is another couple who was married right when we were, except the groom, they both had like 7 and 8 years sober, at their wedding at the start of it. But the groom always had in his mind that he always wanted to do a toast with his dad. It's good. He looks so beautiful. He's dying and wonderful. And so he's got like the champagne and the champagne flute, but he forgot that it was, you know, champagne, that he was going to put it down and not any drinks. And then it starts that restlessness here. And he's describing this in the meeting. And it turns out he went into a blackout, ruined their wedding. They kept on their wedding plans, and he's sober 18 hours on their first night married. And there my wife and I are, and I'm in my head about the air conditioning for about 5 seconds. And it takes one to know one. And then all of a sudden, right size comes in, and I'm like, voila. You see, we had prayed in our wedding and the list that, you know, we would build, put at the center of our lives, God and AA. And contrary to many of my own efforts, honestly, I had to marry an educator because they're the only ones that can put up with the childish silliness that I exhibit, quite honestly. But it's amazing. We built an AA life and built an AA home. You know, and have being able to have a career and travel all over the world. I've lived all over the place. I've worked in several countries, and to this day, I travel for a living, and I get to go to AA meetings. Tomorrow, I'll be in a meeting in San Francisco. I fly tonight, and you know. But at the heart of it, at the heart of everything, is I've never had to sacrifice AA involvement to go pursue academics. I haven't had to sacrifice my AA connection and involvement to be parents. It has transformed how I'm involved. But the one common thread is putting God and AA at the center of my life, and honestly, at the center of everything I've done, has allowed me, contrary to my own thinking, build a life that I absolutely love and wouldn't want it any other way. You know, and you're right, it doesn't look all that different. It doesn't from the outsides, but how I see the world, my relationship to everything. You know, we will see how our experience can benefit others. Well, you know, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will intuitively know how to handle situations through survival. Every single one of the promises has nothing to do with anything I actually get directly. Certainly not material. It's how I connect to everything that's always been there. And so the God in you, I see very clearly on most days when I'm sponsored, when I'm connected, when the newcomer's there and I'm actually paying attention to where I can be of service or where my experience or where your experience can be of service. So I thank you for your time. I'm standing in between you and your lunch. I'm not going to do that anymore. I love you. Thanks.